you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast, coming to you from the cozy comforts of our palatial homes. I'm Max's next-door neighbor, Brian Hoyle, and your host for the evening, they're here, your busy backyard bartenders, the masters of the takeout menu, the homeschooling, home distancing, Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss, and we continue our social distancing, responsible podcasting for the food and beverage community. And we have a great episode for you this week. But before we get to it, just wanted to touch base with Max and talk about a couple of things that happened over the weekend. So, Max, you had a couple of cool things going over this weekend. What happened?
Well, first off, is everyone's house like super clean right now? Because I feel like in the very beginning, my house was kind of dirty. And then I realized like how much I need to clean it and how many times the dishwasher needs to work in a day. And now like the house is kind of spotless. Like we're on it. We are super clean. How say you?
We keep a pretty clean house and I feel like, you know, it's status quo, but not like super extra clean.
I guess you can tell that I don't normally keep a clean house because now it's like a big deal that I mopped. So, but no, I think what you're alluding to, Matt, was Inland Seafood had reached out to us because they're starting a new home delivery program. And they're not like technically sponsors. They're just friends of ours. And, you know, full disclosure, like they're just like, hey, if we sent you some food, would you guys cook it up and share it and, you know, whatever? And we're like, yeah, why not? Let's like we're cooking like crazy. We love you guys. They are awesome distributors in North Carolina. They sell pretty much all over the state, I'm pretty sure. And Inland Seafood, I used to order from them all the time when I was at Midtown Grill. And so just great long-term friendships with those guys. And so they sent us a ton of food, which is crazy. I've mentioned on our stories, and I said to you as well, that pretty much my two neighbors, the families that are next door to us in this like townhome community, are really tight, and we're kind of helping all of each other out. So we'll go to like one of us will go to the grocery store and get all the food, and one of us will do like menial tasks. And so a lot of the stuff is we're sharing a lot of mutual food in this area. So when I told them I was doing this, if you're going to give me some food to cook for, well, I kind of have like a lot of people. So can I get enough food for like 12 people? Like they didn't skip a beat. They're like, yeah, man, sure. And they're used to selling to restaurants in high, like big quantities. And so that was kind of easy and simple. I know for you, you've got a tighter community over at the old Weiss household, but they were able to help you out too, right? They sent you something?
Oh, yeah. They actually reached out to me after they saw your story. They're like, dude, we totally forgot a couple of things in your box. And because my box, I was cooking for my family.
I had a huge bounty. Yeah.
You had a bounty.
So, yeah. But just giving them a shout out, like they did send over some amazing scallops and shrimp and halibut. Believe me, like this is not meant to be, look what I got and whatever. I really know people are out there and they are struggling. I'm not saying that we're not struggling either. So all the help that everybody can give is greatly warranted and appreciated. So when friends, businesses, community can help each other out, I think you should take that help and you should also pass it along and pass it forward. And that's essentially what this is. It's not like we were asking for free food, but they wanted to volunteer it up and help us out. And that was awesome. And so we cooked for the community. We had baby back ribs, mushrooms, oysters, which was awesome. Like we chilled out some oysters and made a little mignonette and just we were shucking and popping those down. It really felt fancy. And especially what I like the most is this is all like restaurant grade quality stuff. So like the scallops were fucking huge. And the halibut was unbelievable. And we got a ton of salamis and cheeses, which were tremendous. We did a little charcuterie board. So paying it forward, just as we're saying, it's Inland Seafood, but they have a website that's set up for home delivery. And that's called domesticseafood.com. you can figure out what you'd like. And to be honest, they're working out their website with quantities and all. And if you have a request that's not within like the quantity that they're offering on the website, you can just email them or shoot it out. Like, they're learning this process too, but they are totally amenable to helping out and trying to give you what you want when you want it. So if you live in the Triangle, if you live in the Charlotte area, in the Triad, on the coast, like, this is Inland Seafood. They deliver all over the state. So hit them up, domesticseafood.com. You are going to find awesome product. Super helpful. Thank you. I saw Matt, you made some scallops yourself. What else were you making?
Well, dude, so you just reminded me, actually. So we got 4 pounds of scallops. So that was 3 nights worth.
Yeah.
Plus I did hook up my neighbors, like, social distancing, dropped it on their doorsteps, what I made. But yeah, so I was like, how am I going to use these scallops and not go to waste? So the first night I did the traditional, just like brown butter, caper, pan seared, beautiful. And then the next night I did a baked scallop dish, which turned out to be really fantastic. Because the whole thing with scallops is, it's, if you overcook them, they're going to get rubbery. And there's a really fine line about where they're well cooked to the where they're overcooked. And then I had also intended to do a scallop ceviche. And so I set it all up. But because actually we got the Inland Seafood that week, I didn't go to the grocery store, which is a feather in their cap that I didn't even have to go to the grocery store because we had so much proteins and stuff to cook for dinner. But so I intended to do a ceviche, but I didn't have the right type of citrus. So I left it in the fridge overnight. And then I was like, well, let me just try and saute this. And then I sauteed it all and it was delicious. It was something that I made as if you had made it a ceviche, left it in the fridge overnight and then sauteed it. And it was perfect.
That
it was
sounds
so
delicious.
Good. It was a lot of orange citrus. And so, but you just reminded me, I still have swordfish steaks to make, which I'm super excited about because that's like my favorite fish.
I know this is not like a cooking show with recipes, but perhaps someone cares and, you know, maybe mention to us like, hey, get on with the show or not. But we'll try just for this moment. That was a really good recipe. I was gifted a recipe, the gents from the Perrin family, which is like Chateau de Beaucastel and Côtelet de Beaucastel, Perrin family, like just really amazing Southern French Rhone wines. And one of the guys had said to me, take this bottle of... And I always forget this every single time. What's the Viognier, the 100% Viognier, that's the region that is tends to be 100% Viognier in Northern...
Condrieu,
yeah. He's like, take this bottle of Condrieu home, which you and I both know is a really expensive, nice bottle of wine from the Perrin family. He's like, take 2 raw oysters, shallots, garlic, butter, a little bit of white wine, and throw in some spinach after everything kind of softens. Once you've cooked that down, hit it in a hand mixer, like, you know, put it in a bowl and hit it with a hand mixer and puree that whole thing down. And you have this unctuous, like, rich sauce, and just dollop that onto a plate and put your scallops on top of it. You don't need to season or salt the scallops at all because what you've just created is so salty and savory that everything works. And so that's been like my go-to recipe. And I did that for everyone. And people were like, dude, can I get some more of that sauce? Like, I just ended up gifting it out so everyone can go home. You could throw that on like a pasta the next day and it'd be perfect, but delicious.
Yeah. And those scallops were primo. I mean, they were so good. It would be hard to screw them up.
Yeah. All right, let's get into this. So we recorded with Chef Brandon Sharp, who now, if you're following along for these last few episodes, we've already spoke with Neil Benefield, who is the general manager of Hawthorn and Wood, who was gracious enough to come up on the show recently. But Brandon Sharp, who is the chef owner, was gracious enough to come into the studios at the kitchen and was the second to last person that we actually brought into the studio before the quarantine hit. And we've been sitting on it, and it's just, I don't know, like, it just makes sense to talk about fancy fine wine and food when we're about to have graduation and Mother's Day, and a lot of people have anniversaries around this time. I know I do, but it's kind of like wedding season. So I imagine this is a good celebratory time for a lot of people, and why not talk to a chef that knows a shit ton about great cuisine and get inspired, because this guy is so inspired as a chef. It was really fun re-listening to this episode. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah. He's the reason, one of the reasons that we do this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a chef that's of enormous ballyhoo. Yes, he is 7-time Michelin star awarded.
Yeah.
However, he's not a name that, you know, anybody would recognize except in these parts and maybe in California. However, he's really a chef's dream. I mean, he has built it from A to Z. He's done everything he needs to do. He's worked in New York, San Francisco, and now back in North Carolina. He's doing exactly what he wants, and he has the family and the whole thing, and he's back home, and he's doing great food, and he's got a restaurant that's sustainable for a lot of years to come. So it's just a great story.
Yeah, I appreciated that we were able to kind of get in the weeds with him about like real technical chef life or restaurant life. Like we were talking about the menu and how you price things out and pricing out a burger and coexisting like with being kind of fancy but also casual and really making what he does work in a restaurant in these modern times, if you will. But we got deep into it and it was really I loved it, you know. I love all of our episodes like they're little children, but I love this one a little extra special. It was fun.
Yeah, it was refreshing, especially given the time to go back to that time and just hear a great story about a really great chef.
Yeah. So let's get ready for the show. This is awesome. This episode with Brandon Sharp of Hawthorne and Wood was recorded probably like at the beginning of March, just to give you a timestamp, and we'll go from there.
Enjoy the show.
Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast and your host for the evening, Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss, and the stars are sharp inside the studio here today as we welcome a 7-time Michelin star awarded chef for his work out in Soul Bar at Calistoga, California. That's Napa for those of you that don't know. But now you might know him as the chef, owner, founder, creator, the everything man over at Hawthorne and Wood in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Chef Brandon Sharp. Welcome.
Good morning, fellas. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah.
7 Michelin awards?
7 in a row.
7 in a row. That is crazy, man. How does that... So California didn't do a lot of Michelin, or they went like for a short amount of time and then Michelin pulled out. Is that right?
That was in Los Angeles. Yes. Yeah. So I worked at Gary Danko. I was the sous chef at Gary Danko in San Francisco, 2004, 2006. And I believe, could be getting this wrong, but I believe that the first time San Francisco did a Michelin guide was 2007. So Michelin guides go by city. They don't go by state in the U.S. So right now it's Chicago, New York. Washington has one. New York obviously has one. And they've started this year, I guess last year for the first time, they did all of California.
Yeah.
So it's changed up a little bit. I don't know how it's going to shake out now, but they did L.A. for a while and then stopped.
Isn't it amazing that Michelin guide, this universal thing that we accept in the restaurant world or as part of this industry, is so hyper-regional at the same time?
Yeah, I think it is. And if you think back to the evolution of those types of things and how Zagat used to be the Bible for that.
Right.
I guess it was 20 years ago, and that sort of evolved out. I haven't heard anybody mention the Zagat guide in a long time.
No. The last time I remember was Chris Farley talking about Zagats on SNL like 22 years ago. But maybe that's just generational because of the person that was the writer or the person that was leading the charge, and they retire or they move on. And
right. The
next generation, the technology changes. So it's like, oh, let's do this online. Let's not do a little pamphlet. Because everyone had that little maroon pamphlet.
I was going to say, it was on everybody's coffee table.
Yep.
Yeah. Zagats, but yeah, Zagat. Yeah, that was a cool thing. I remember in Los Angeles, because I was working for Wolfgang at the time, Spago got 2 stars. Melisse got 2 stars, and Urazawa got 2 stars. And then I think there were 8 stars given, 1 star given to a few other restaurants in the town. And then we thought, well, great, we're here. Los Angeles has arrived. And then Michelin came out the next year and went, oh, we're not coming back.
Right. And they did the same thing in Vegas. Yeah.
So I don't know. That's interesting. So working for Gary Danko, though, that's for those that, you know, we're talking about California and San Francisco and all, but for those that don't know here in North Carolina, that was, it still is, like, that's a badass restaurant group, restaurant in general, and forward thinking. You guys are doing anything. Like, what was the environment like there? back in 04.
That was intense. He had two sous chefs at the time, Colin Basler and Sean O'Brien. And Sean O'Brien had left a month before I got to San Francisco or so. And he went on to, he got a Food & Wine Best New Chef the next year at the restaurant that he worked at. So it was an intense environment. Every night was Saturday night, open 7 days a week. When I started there, we were doing 120 covers a night, and that felt like full gas. And then 2 years later, when I left, we were doing 150 to 160 a night. And it was relentless. It was quite a valuable glimpse into an operation that is just running full bore and running very efficiently.
More intense than when you were at the French Laundry, or
intense in a different way, for sure. As the sous chef there, as opposed to just being a chef de partie at the French Laundry, it required a lot of. Middle management is tough anywhere.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
you take stuff from below and you take it from above. But really running that kitchen at French Laundry, I'm sorry, running that kitchen at Gary Danko, was just having to stay on top of the cooks all the time and drive them and find the motivation to keep them pedal down myself too.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, we're talking a lot about California and we're talking about Northern California. It's kind of, you're from Greensboro,
right?
But you definitely made your cooking bones elsewhere, and a lot in Northern California. So you went to Hyde Park to culinary school,
right?
And then how did you shape your career as a young culinary student?
There's a really fun class. It's taught in one of the very first few weeks of the Culinary Institute. It's called Culinary History or Epicureanism or something like that. But anyway, the instructor had this sheaf of menus from all over the country, from all the best restaurants. And so we would just kind of paw through those and look for the most exciting ones. And this was right before the French Laundry cookbook had come out. And the French Laundry menu was part of that stack. And we just kind of oohed and aahed over it. In the way that I remember the stories, I decided right then that's where I wanted to work. And what's great about the Culinary Institute was that the chefs there, they teach one class and then they repeat it 7 days later. So they're pretty bored. The program there has tapped into, what do you want to call that? 1/100th, 1/1000th of what they know. And so it's an opportunity to really get out of it what you put into it. And so any extra questions, any work you do with the instructors after class, they always have a side hustle going on, whether it's a catering gig,
sure,
or
writing
special event, yeah, all that stuff. So helping them out with those things really helps with connections. And so one of the kind of weed out classes there is called Skills One, and that one is a kitchen where you're with the same instructor for 6 weeks. And my instructor was a guy named Terrell Brunet. He's from Mandeville, Louisiana, and good old boy, but a great chef. And so I had a great connection with him, had a great class with him. And so he set me up with an externship at a place in New York City called The Tonic, which was between Chelsea and Union Square on 16th, I believe. It's no longer there. With his friend Dave Honeysett, who is the executive sous chef, and the chef was Chris Gisualdi. So Gisualdi had been at Montrachet, which is now Batard, but it was a Drew Neprant restaurant, and he'd gotten 3 stars from Ruth Reichel there. And before that, Chris had been at Raquel with Thomas Keller, where Thomas had his restaurant in New York for 10 years. And so through that series of connections, I was able to, during my second term at culinary school, stage at the French Laundry.
Okay.
I had to fly out to flew from JFK on an airline called Tower Air.
Yeah.
Which it's no longer, but you could check your knives and bring them on Tower Air. I mean, it's like this crazy weird
that
freight
airline
train
for chefs. You can check your knives.
Yeah, it was probably a good thing it doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
but that's the circuitous route by which I got to the French Laundry.
Okay. Well, we probably also have some same chef tree then, because at Montrachet at the time might have been David Boulay, who I worked for.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Back in the late aughts, as they call them. Mm-hmm. But anyway, And then you talked about, and we'll transition this back to North Carolina pretty soon, because one of the things that you said, and the reason I bring up the Michelin stars and the whole regionality of it, is you find some freedom in bringing your restaurant back to North Carolina where you're from, and you have this history that we'll get into in Chapel Hill, but coming here and being that there's no Michelin star rated restaurants here, that the Michelin guy doesn't exist here. So, that, I guess, gives you license to be more casual. Is that the thing?
I think so. And I know the listeners can't see the smile on my face when you said there's no Michelin guide in North Carolina. But, one of my greatest days in the kitchen was when I got the call from Jean-Luc Nouret telling us that we had a star. I just ran and tackled the chef de cuisine, and then the whole kitchen just drank champagne the rest of the day. I mean, it was fantastic. Day. And but the pressure that mounted with every year was real, and it was difficult to deal with. So the goal with Hawthorne and Wood was not to make it a more casual restaurant, and the goal with Soul Bar was never to make it fancy or fine dining. When I was first told about that job, it was, you're going to open a wine country bistro, you're going to serve grilled chicken with arugula and pizza and burgers, and it's a spa resort, and it's on the second tier of the Auberge Collection. It's not fine dining, but we were able to elevate it, and when we showed the owners and the general manager, we can do a great pizza, we can do a great grilled chicken salad, you know, they gave us a little more rope all the time. So we evolved it organically, I think.
Isn't that crazy? Like, from the consumer or guest perspective, you're on wine country time, right? Like, you're there and having fun, and probably a lot of people are not necessarily industry people that you were serving, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And like, but you don't see like the grind, the sweat behind the kitchen of like just bringing out that what you think is pizza and comfort food, because you probably have been imbibing all day on pizza. I mean, on wine, and it's just like comfort food, but like the sweat. And that's exactly like one of the reasons that this show exists, is like what's going on behind that chef that's creating that food's mind, and like the stress that you have, like, oh shit, I got a Michelin star. I need to do that again.
So I want to give a little bit of a shout out to the Folks Foundation, the champions of all good things crafted in North Carolina, and the folks that make them. And check it out. There's something new that they're doing. They are producing a compilation vinyl album. Yeah, like a record, like a real spinning record called the Carolina Quarantine Project, where Carolina-based musicians and duos showcase songs written while sheltered in place. Pre-sales for the vinyl album start May 1st and will be released in June, and all sales go directly to the artists. Some of the artists that are featured are Couldn't Be Happier's, Migrant Birds, Stray Local, Ghosts of Liberty, Neville's Quarter, and His and Hers. So check them out. Follow them on Instagram at Folks Foundation, or check them out online at folksfoundation.org. Remember, they are champions of all good things crafted in North Carolina and the folks that make them. Folks Foundation. So, Chef,
when you were getting going, did you have these delusions of grandeur? Like, I'm going to be the greatest chef in the world. Did you say, where were you when you were kind of starting your career?
Yeah, I'm trying to think back on that. I don't remember like an ambition crystallizing that clearly, but I do remember, I mean, I started out as a busboy at a Chi Chi's, and then, you know, worked summers on Nantucket in a sandwich shop and a really crappy Italian restaurant. And I went back to Nantucket and worked at a better restaurant called the Quaker House after I graduated from college. And before work, most days I would go to one of the two bookstores on the island, there right by the restaurant. And the chef was a guy named Kendrick Anderson, who had a great grounding in the classics. And but I remember going to the bookstores, and after a while, instead of going to the fiction section before work, I realized I was ending up in the cookbook section. And so that just, you know, it was just a gradual process. I thought of myself as, I would be a writer someday, or I would be this, or I'd be that. And then, you know, and the first cookbook I bought at one of those stores was Bobby Flay's Bold American Food. And so, like, I have all these little touchstones that I remember along the way of my career. And I think just before long, I realized that I was a restaurant worker, you know, and that's what I was. And then I went to culinary school, and culinary school is a mile wide and 2 inches deep. There's so much information that they try to cram into, but you're exposed to an unbelievable array of things. And as I said before, some great connections.
What I love about your story, though, is it's a little bit different from a lot of the chefs we talked to, in the sense that, like, some of the chefs, they came from nothing, right? Mm-hmm. They really, and then they found themselves working. You're obviously, you worked as a busboy and stuff, but you were well educated. You went to UNC Chapel Hill, mm-hmm. And you, it seems like you already had graduated college and you had some options. What did you study at Chapel Hill?
I studied philosophy, so there. Okay, yeah, I didn't get a ton of calls from recruiters. Yeah, exactly. Well, and when I worked at the Weather Vane when it was out at Eastgate, where the Trader Joe's is now. When I was in college, and the chef there, Devin Mills, he asked me the same thing. He said, "What are you studying?" I said, "Philosophy." He said, "You're going to be in kitchens for a while, kid." So yeah, prophetic.
But I mean, still, if you have that piece of paper that says you went to UNC, let's be honest, it does open some doors to you.
Yeah, like, I'm sure. I don't remember that in a concrete or tangible manner, but I'm sure it did.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so did you go right after to culinary school?
No, then that's when I went back to Nantucket and cooked for pretty much a full year there.
Okay.
And then realized, okay, I'm semi to mostly serious about this.
Right.
Let's start looking at culinary schools.
Got it.
Such a weird, like the restaurant sucked you in. Like, you got mm-hmm. this moment of saying, oh, I like this. This is fun. But Matt and I have talked about, like, people that get into the restaurant industry are cut from a different cloth, whether they're like the self-loathing or they feel the need to service other people and mm-hmm. do all these things. Like the need to help and be hospitable to people is kind of just innate in your body, you know, and you have to do it. And so whether you went to a higher learning school or not, you're like, I like doing this. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what it means, it's like, it's just, it's something you want to do, I guess.
It's also a really good source for income, right? You can make money, you keep busy. And the other thing that I talk about with people, and this is a much more of a general topic, but when you're in the restaurant industry, it gives you an automatic social life. Because the people that you work with, you're on the same time and the same schedule. And usually, like I think you've said it before, the restaurant industry are the misfits of like the rest of society, because your schedule is so opposite and you're there to serve people. So you're kind of incubated into this social whatever. You have a social circle automatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But speaking of the social circle of Hawthorne and Wood, to bring it back here. So you were working in Napa. You had opened up a second restaurant that actually you had ownership of.
Yes.
And then you gave that all up to come back to Carolina to work at the Carolina Inn.
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct. It was an interesting time at – so Solage is the name of the resort that, where Soul Bar was. It was being sold. It was a great selling situation for our owner, and we'd had the same small family private equity firm own the resort from the beginning. And I had been there. I was there, you know, while the place was still studs and mud. It was still being built when I was hired, the resort, that is. And so I had a great relationship with them. They actually helped me open Evangeline, which was the French Creole bistro that we opened in Calistoga and have subsequently sold to the fellow who was the general manager there when we started, Sasan Nayeri.
Oh, nice.
And it's still going strong. It's great. Just celebrated its fifth anniversary. So that change in ownership was coming with a change in general manager.
I see.
And so a lot of the core crew and executive team with which I had been very close was dispersing. And so it seemed like a natural time for a transition, and the tug of coming back to North Carolina was pretty strong. My folks are still in Greensboro. My brother's up in Asheville with his family, and my wife, Elizabeth, thought it'd be a great idea for us to come back to Chapel Hill.
Is she from Chapel Hill?
No, she's from the Bay Area, but she grew up in Chicago.
Okay, mm-hmm. Got it. And so you sought out a job back here?
It was a bit serendipitous. I clicked on Craigslist, I think it was, and boom. Executive chef at the Carolina Inn. The job was open.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. So I emailed them. They called me back shortly. I had a couple great phone conversations. Flew out here. I guess that was August of 2016. Elizabeth and I did, tried out for the job, did an extensive tasting for them, and moved back for good in October.
You know, serendipitously, do you know who the chefs were? I believe who the executive chefs were. And they left.
James Clark and Bill
James
Hartley.
James and Bill. Yeah, they had left in like July or something.
To go open their own restaurant, right. Obviously.
To open
Postal Fish Company out in Pittsburgh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just funny how this world of ours goes around. Yeah. So that's funny. So you come back to North Carolina. And then the Carolina Inn obviously has this history, but you're in Chapel Hill where you had spent a lot of time.
Right. I think
your grandparents were from there. And but when you come back, you're executing kind of the food of the Carolina Inn, right? Like you're not executing, I'm sure you have some leeway, but you're really executing somebody else's menu at that point. Is that right?
Well, at first, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I have looked at the Carolina Inn as just this giant, beautiful, you know, ocean liner. Steaming along, and right. You can only hope to change the course by a couple tenths of a degree at a time or so. But our general manager Mark Sherburn was fantastic. He never told me that I couldn't do this or couldn't do that, and it was more about what the guests would accept and what the guests' expectations were, because they. You know, a lot of alumni came back there, and they might be from up north or they might be from out west, and they don't. Eat Southern food or have exposure to it where they are. So when they come back, they expect a good dose of it at the Carolina Inn. Mm. I mean, the Carolina Inn for alumni is kind of like the Uber UNC. Like it is what they think of when they think of Carolina. And so the food needed to portray that a little bit. We had a lot of fun with the dishes there, and the dinner menu was by far the most dynamic. Breakfast and lunch were relatively status quo, again, because of the guest expectations. But I had a great, I think of him as Virgil, but Jeremy Blankenship was the executive sous chef there that I hired, and now he's gone on to become the chef there. And he was really instrumental with, you know, explaining to me a lot of guest expectations, introductions to farmers, other chefs, and things like that. And so he and I had a great collaboration there.
Yeah, that's got to be different, just sourcing in general. I did a spinoff podcast with Candace Harriet Townsend where we spoke with Sean Brock, and the idea was that, like, how did he successfully move from Charleston to Nashville, and then how did he find his sourcing and his people? Mm-hmm. When you're in the Bay Area, everything is available. There's,
yeah.
You pretty much want for nothing when it comes to agriculture and even cattle. Everything is just pretty much there. So was there an adjustment for you understanding how the state worked and how Chapel Hill worked for you? And what was that like?
Yes, there was a big adjustment for sure. But again, the Carolina Inn had such buying power that I was flooded with requests from purveyors and farmers and vendors all the time. So it was a crash course in what's available.
Yeah, I guess everybody comes to you when you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the pretty girl.
When you can buy their entire crop, it's an advantage.
Yeah.
But no, it's funny. I was thinking about this when I was driving here, because from one of our produce vendors, I got an email this morning was, this is what's being grown organically, locally, and on site today. And there were two varieties of lettuce, and that was it. And so during months like these, it takes some creativity on the part of the chef to come up with things that are still compelling and local, and you know, source from a short radius and support the local sort of ancillary industries that go into the restaurant. During the summer, obviously, you can go any direction. You go to the farmer's market, and the tables are overflowing. So that's a fantastic problem.
Which is a weird
have.
Thing. Like in California, I was always helping chefs when we were like working on seasonal menus, but we never thought about like in the winter months, oh, we're only going to be working with root vegetables and all that, because we had everything. We were like, we're just going to change the menu. Like basically it always seemed like the same season in California. Like you could, because you could
in Southern California for sure.
Everything at all times, you know? Mm-hmm. So you're getting everything. Only until I moved to North Carolina that I realized, oh wow. Yeah. When you're doing that winter menu, everything changes. Like there's so much that you're not going to be able to get. And so unless you source Mexico and all these other places, if you're trying to get the best quality product, that sometimes isn't the best way to source. But that in itself is a different dynamic in just coming from both sides. That's how at Hawthorne and Wood you guys are focused, right? You're hyper-seasonal.
Yeah, so at Hawthorne and Wood, we really have put no restrictions on what approach we take to the menu, because there's so many things that we want to eat. We are always excited. We're always talking about what we're gonna serve next, and excited for what's coming in the back door. We don't source asparagus in November. We don't source peaches in December. We don't, you know, there are a lot of no-goes for me when it comes to seasonality, just that have just been drilled into me from 10 straight years spent in Northern California. And you know, one thing that we found. Again, the fellow just knocked on the back door. The farmer at Vera Luce Farms is growing these amazing chicories. And so we have this amazing Rosa del Veneto and Escarole salad on the menu. that is just, I mean, it's unbelievable. But that's a very specific thing. And chicories are, you know, a bitter green that a lot of Americans are not used to cooking with. You know, and a lot of what you're alluding to goes back to I don't know if it's a longstanding feud, but it's certainly a current one between East Coast chefs and West Coast chefs. And East Coast chefs thinking of West Coast chefs as farmers or grocers and not chefs, and West Coast chefs thinking that East Coast chefs manipulate the food too much. And so it does, you know, and on the West Coast, you know, you have the point or the story where this was conflict was when I think David Chang made a joke about the peach with the knife at Zuni. That's like a $9 peach, and that's all you get is a peach and a knife to cut it with. But on the West Coast, you know, sometimes the chef needs to set his ego aside and let the product really speak for himself. And you know, I served a peach salad to a New York chef who said, "Oh man, I can't remember the last time I had peaches that weren't grilled." And so I think from his point of view, the flavors just take so much more coaxing, and the products take so much more coaxing that it does require more manipulation on the part of the chef. And so at Hawthorne and Wood, we're always looking for the balance between those two things. Like, you know, you look at the perfect tomato, it's a two-step process. You peel it, you salt it, you put it on the plate. You can't make it any better. But if it's short rib, let's say, that's a 12-step process. Yeah. Maybe that's a 48-hour process to make that shine. I think it takes some know-how, some expertise, some experience, and at times some restraint on the chef.
I'm just thinking that the whole Tupac and Biggie lyrics give a whole different meaning now with the East Coast, West Coast feud. I mean, I really got to go back.
That's what they were really fighting about, right?
Exactly. The chef and the culinary world.
I have to choose the East.
That's right.
I live out there, so don't go there.
Okay, we've gotten a little bit in Hawthorne and Wood.
Matt, didn't you just eat?
I did just eat there on Friday night, and so you had tilefish, which I'm pretty sure was from the North Carolina waters. Yeah. Where else do you get tilefish? It's pretty much a North Carolina like native, right?
Yeah, as far as I know, we got it from local seafood and those guys. We get most of our seafood from them.
It was awesome, and then there were some root vegetables on the plate, and
right. So it's thistle season for us. There were sunchokes on there, artichokes,
a lot of sunchokes,
Meyer lemon. So, you know, good seasonal things. And then this is a cool thing to do. I mean, you can grow parsley any time of year. So there's a caper persillade on there, which adds a brightness and an intensity to the dish and is olive oil based. So it has a summery or a spring-like feel to it, even though, you know, it's Meyer lemons and we're still kind of in the dead of winter. So,
because it has that nice citrus base anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you were explaining in an elevator pitch to somebody about Hawthorne and Wood, what would you say about the restaurant?
So Hawthorne and Wood, this occurred to me the other day. You know, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, a restaurant must be worth several million.
Mm.
But something happened on Sunday night that really, you know, crystallized Hawthorne and Wood for me. And I came out to check on a few late tables and say goodbye to a guest that was leaving, and ended up speaking to a middle-aged couple that was leaving, dressed very nicely and very complimentary about the food and Claude, their server. And the woman said to me, "Yeah, but you know, we're just so hillbilly that we shared our dessert with the table next to us." And so that's the best I can do with putting like that convivial spirit and that sense of hospitality that I want Hawthorne and Wood to be, in addition to great wine, great cocktails, great food. Like that's what I want to capture. I want that experience to be what the words Hawthorne and Wood mean to people. I want them to have, you know, great memories of the place.
Yeah. You know, Max, it just reminds me of something I said to you when I first moved out to North Carolina, because the location where you are is great. I mean, you have a residential community, you have a built-in community. That place is always hopping for people that know it's right off 54, and you have Bottle Rev there, and you have Elements there, and those establishments are always busy. So from a business perspective, you chose a great location. Not that you wouldn't have been successful anywhere. But for people that live outside the Triangle or outside of North Carolina, like coming from especially New York and Manhattan, when you see restaurants in the strip mall, you automatically think, "Oh, this is a chain restaurant, or this is just a matter of convenience. It can't be good," you know. But then, like, the ironic thing is, then you walk into Hawthorne and you built this from the studs, pretty much. I mean, it was a restaurant prior, but I think you completely gutted it, and it's super chic, I will say. Not like fancy and intimidating way, but it looks very cool. It's a cool vibe. You have like some Is there a fire within, or just thinking that in my mind now?
A fire?
Yeah. Is there there's no fire.
That was against
code. But it feels that kind of way, right? Like yeah. It's Hawthorne and Wood. Yeah. I mean, I know those are the names of neighborhood, but it's a very chic environment.
Thank you.
And it's inside, but yeah, at the same time, it's not intimidating at all. And another testament to that is I had this chicken confit, which was essentially like buffalo chicken wings, uh-huh. but just prepared immaculately and like perfectly crispy, fall off the bone kind of thing. So
thank you. Well, that was an invention of our sous chef, John Navaria. And so we had Poussin, which is the small chicken, the Cornish hen, on the menu in the fall. And he went to the trouble of, when we would French out the wing bones, he would take the wing bones off, French them further, confit them, and we were using them as canapes for private parties.
Okay.
And we tossed them at a Texas Pete guest streak that he made, and there's a drizzle of buttermilk ravigote, which, you know, resembles a ranch dressing, and then celery leaf and things like that. So we're really looking for ways to have fun with the menu and make it intelligible to people who, you know, they may look at it, and I want the menu to read as scintillating, not intimidating. Mm. You know, it should pique their interest without throwing a bunch of foreign words on there that
people don't know.
Try and be fancy. Like yeah. that's not the point. The point is to welcome people in, you know?
I think you're at that point. We had Chef Daniel Schur of Second Empire on not too long ago, a few months back, and you know, talking about fine dining, and of course the places that you've worked in the past, these are pretty elegant places and white tablecloth and all. That's not Hawthorne and Wood. You guys literally do have right. wood tables and so there's like a casual aspect of higher level cuisine, mm-hmm. I guess, in a way, which feels like that's what everybody wants. Like we all want yeah. great food, obviously. That's no shit. But we want great food, and we don't want to feel like we have to wear a tie or a sport exactly. coat to do it. But also, you know, but I also might be with my executives and have a corporate card that goes out there, and we want to get a nice bottle of wine, and mm-hmm. we want to know that the guy in the kitchen or the gal in the kitchen knows what the hell they're doing. You're giving an outlet to those that really enjoy dining, but in an approachable sense, which it feels hard to go back to, like the white tablecloth yeah. and you know, the gloves and all that.
Yeah. I don't aspire to that.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think those places have their place, but it's much less of them in the world now than, right. you know, 5-10 years ago. But yeah, but you, Hawthorne and Wood, and you guys have seemed to like walk that line perfectly between fancy but unintimidating, mm-hmm. like you said, mm-hmm. scintillating but not intimidating. And I just wonder that, like, okay, let's take the burger, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, you have a burger on the dinner menu. Some restaurants or some chefs will be like, I'm not putting a fucking burger on the right. dinner menu, you know, but like, but you did. And
yeah,
it's,
and that's the one thing that will never change.
Yeah, and so. It sounds, I haven't had it yet, but I know actually Maddie Beeson and Steve Mangano were at the bar the other night when I went in there and chowing down on a burger, and they were just like, this might be the best burger I've ever had. Well, like, it's just unbelievable.
We joke about it all the time, and the guy in the middle who works the burger station, we're razzing him, you know, what happens if we get a burger award?
Seriously.
You are just
so my old chef didn't want to put a burger menu on the dinner menu only because he didn't want the kitchen to be inundated with burgers all night long, because we had fine, like high-end food, and we did a burger at lunch, and everyone said,
Standard or Midtown?
At Midtown. And Scott James, who's over at Angus Barn now, making a lot of burgers. No, making yeah. a lot of meat. But he was like, look, I have no, like, I endorse my burger all the way to the top. I think it's the best burger in town. But if we put it on the dinner menu, that's the only thing people are going to order. And I want to have a little bit more diversity on the menu. And, you know, this is the time to explore, to try the pork chop or the seafood dish or whatever. Plus also just the mechanics of killing the guy on mm-hmm. the burger line. It's like, yeah, we got 12 tickets up, 19 nice. Burgers. It's
like, so, you know, a lot of... this is fun that we're talking about this. A lot of calculus went into whether or not that burger is going to go on the menu. You know, first of all, our general manager, Neil Benefield, he really sets the tone for the dining room.
Yeah.
And so he
we love
really,
Neil. Over here, yeah.
yeah. Me too.
For those of me you, too. You probably have known, he worked at Nana's for years and was the yeah. face of the dining room there.
Yeah. And worked at, and then worked at Pools right before he came over to Hawthorne right, Woods. Right. So he's really, you know, he's where it's at when it comes to the dining room. And so he's, yeah, I'm getting feedback from him about what guests want and what guests order. So, you know, a couple things that went into, are we putting a burger on the dinner menu? Well, at Evangeline, we did burgers once a week, and I got all sorts of requests that we need a burger on the menu all the time.
Yeah.
And going into opening Hawthorne and Wood, knowing that ladies make 8, 9 out of 10 of the reservations that are on the book. Like the women are deciding where we're going to go for dinner. And so it seems to me that burgers appeal a little bit more to men than to women, especially eating them in a setting like Hawthorne and Wood. There are certainly exceptions to this rule because we have a group of 7 ladies from the country club who come in and order bottles of Chardonnay and burgers for everybody. So, but you know, I think the exception proves the rule on that.
Sure, kind of ladies.
Yeah. And then also we have 13 seats at the bar and no TV. I want people to feel comfortable coming in by themselves, and maybe they're traveling from somewhere else. Maybe they were told Hawthorne and Wood is great, but nothing on the menu appeals to them. Please stay and have a burger and a glass of cab, glasses in, you know, an old fashioned, whatever it's going to be. And then, lastly, the servers are motivated by money, among other things, but they're motivated by money. So a server makes more money selling a $28 pork chop than a $14 burger.
Absolutely.
So that is that's a real part of the equation as well. And so I don't get upset when people order burgers. I'm super glad that they're there having a burger. There's also some trust building, right? If they come in and love the burger, maybe they'll come back for their anniversary and have a bottle of champagne and the pork chop.
Is it your number one seller, like by far?
No, not even close.
Okay, good. Yeah. It's funny. So we were just at the DPAC last night for the Bull City food and beer experience, where there were 30 breweries and 30 restaurants all just going crazy. And we were at Nana Steak at the after party hanging out, and I was talking to a chef. I'll just keep his name out of the specifics. Didn't really matter, but he was talking about burgers. We talked about burgers again, but we were talking about pricing of burgers, and Jeff Sizer walks right by us, and Jeff Sizer runs and owns Royale, and they're known for a great burger.
Yeah.
And Jeff probably charges, forgive me, Jeff, for not knowing how much your burger is, but maybe $15-16, let's call it. And but then also Ashley at Chuck's has her burger as well, and it might be in the same ballpark. And the chef was talking, and he's like, yeah, but Ashley has the James Beard Outstanding Chef Award and is one, and she's nationally recognized. Ashley can charge whatever the fuck she wants. She's not going to overcharge. She's going to be competitive because she's a great chef. She understands business, but she gets a little more leeway because people intentionally will come out there and go, I want an Ashley Christensen burger, and so I'll pay an extra dollar or two. Whereas if you're a small independently owned restaurant that doesn't have a lot of notoriety, it's hard to price out a burger, which is an expensive food cost item. Like when you put burger, bun, cheese, vegetables, all that together, almost all burgers are like 40% food cost. Unless you're really cutting down on horrible meat or horrible products. But if you're doing it in the same fashion that you're doing everything else at Hawthorne and Wood, I would just assume, and you don't have to tell me, but I would assume your burger is probably not the most profitable of all things. But it depends on like who's giving you that burger. As like how you can price it, how it's perceived in the community.
I think that's certainly part of it. And I also think that, would you pay the same burger? Would you expect to pay the same for it at the Ritz as you would, a Whataburger with the screen door on front? So I think that's part of it too.
Yeah. I guess if you're like at a cozy seat, it's worth an extra quarter or something.
And yeah. And have the option of drinking great wine or a great cocktail.
Yeah. That's speaking of California and like Napa, I always love going to Gott's.
Oh yeah.
And getting a burger and having like a really nice glass of cab. Like it's just a burger joint, but you're getting like an $18 glass of Cabernet with your burger that's probably $14. Yeah. But it's a great dynamic because a burger in general is kind of a perfect food in itself. And then matching it with great wine, it's like you really can't do a better pairing.
Well, I'll take this opportunity to mention the Triangle Wine Company, which also has great options for wine. You can bring food in there because they generally don't do food, but they have a great bar that you can sit at and drink great beers. They often have releases of all your favorite beers and availability of all your favorite beers. They also have 4 locations around the Triangle: Holly Springs, Morrisville, Cary, and then out in Southern Pines. They will deliver also. So if you go to trianglewineco.com, they will give you a delivery. And also if you use the NCFB promo code, they will give you a 10% at least discount. Sometimes if they're feeling good, they might give you more of a discount. But I shop there. I think a lot of our listeners shop there. They're great people and they have a great selection. So
And right before we get back, we also got to give a shout out to eHungry.com. eHungry, they are brand new on sponsoring the podcast as well. But this is this conversation is going more from business owners to business owners. This is a little bit more inside baseball. But if you are running, say, a business like a restaurant, like a Hawthorne and Wood, let's say, or a Royale or Ashley out there with your restaurants, and you want to develop an online resource to sell your lunch items or pickup, takeout, doing everything to find another way of generating revenue, well, eHungry.com is a great way to go. They have free setup, free updates, but they will build out your online portal for food and delivery and ordering services. And the first 30 days are free when you start up with eHungry.com. And because you are a listener of the NCFMB, you can actually turn that into 60 days of no fees, and let eHungry help you build out your restaurant ordering service and generate more revenue for your business.
Yeah, this is a no-brainer if you're a chef and you're looking to at least increase your takeout business or your revenue in some way. I mean, at no cost to you, and they'll literally work with you to build out your platform in however way you need, and it's of no cost to you for 60 days, like you said. So
yeah,
use it, eHungry.com. Back to the wine for a second. So you, that's another differentiating factor about you. You take a lot of pride in your wine list, and you actually, I mean, in my day job, we dealt a lot, and you have pretty advanced palate for, I guess, because of living out in wine country for a long time. And I know they teach it a little bit at culinary school, but I know a lot of chefs, and either they don't give a damn or they're just they don't have time to focus on the wine program. But you have made a decided. I know Neil takes care of a lot of it, but you have been an integral part in that. So why is that important to you?
It was great meeting Neil, you know, for many reasons, but wine was certainly one of them. And it was always interesting to Elizabeth and I. We'd, you know, go out to eat in California, and the wine menus are very West Coast focused, and then come to New York or come to somewhere on the East Coast, and they're very European centric, or much more so. And I think the reasons for that are obvious, but I prefer the lower alcohol and higher acid wines more than the California style. But I do have a lot of friends out there, a lot of friends in the wine business. You just mentioned Gott's Burgers. I mean, we have Joel's Sauvignon Blanc on our our By the Glass list, and probably always will.
Yeah, I can't penetrate that stuff.
it's delicious, and it's delicious, and the price is right.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, wine. First, learning about it, you know, in a structured way in culinary school was fascinating. It's just it's a mixture of science and romance that goes into it that can't ever be recreated in a lab or recreated with a recipe. It changes every year, and then just being in Napa Valley, surrounded by friends who made it, and it's part of the culture. I mean, Napa Valley, it's the one place in the United States where people go just to eat and drink. Like, that's all you do there. Yeah. You can ride in a hot air balloon, but really there's nothing else to do. And so, you know, you can open a can of beer and go ride your lawnmower or watch a game, but when you open a bottle of wine, there is some romance to it, and it is a convivial experience. So I really, when we put together the structure of the wine list, there is a small reserve list with some very cool blue chip wines on it, but the bulk of the list is $75 and under, and that is a very conscious choice. The entire main list is priced that way because I really want people to have that experience of having a great bottle of wine that they don't have to pay a ton for. You know, we don't put austere wines on the menu. We put things on there that are easy for the servers to explain and easy for the guests to understand. And Neil will certainly geek out with you if you're a guest at our restaurant on wine as much as you want to.
Yeah.
Because he's really into it, and so are some of our servers, and they are really good at it. But if you don't even want to have to think about it, you know, we'll pop up on a bottle for you that you will absolutely love. So
this is a smart wine list. I'm looking at it right now online. I mean, you've got 4 sparkling, 3 rosé, and then a mixture of about 20 whites and 20 reds. It's a tight list. Then you have also a reserve list on the back end. But it's the type of menu that Matt and I appreciate. It's like, you don't need the 700-page book, but you need a concise book that also maybe is not all represented by one distributor that has just like, oh, here are all the driver wines that we're just trying to push through and get through. It's really hard to find great wine at restaurants. I don't know why. It's like we really got to do a better effort out there to like those that get it, really get it. And then there's so many in between that don't understand. They're just like, oh, we'll just, you know, put a Cab, put a Merlot, put a people like Malbec, right? Yeah, put that on there. No, man, you got to try all the wines. And then you don't have a menu item, a food menu item that's $110, right? Like, except for
a bottle of wine. So you should spend a lot of effort and thought about as much as you do with the pork chop that you're going to prepare, because you're asking your guests to spend a lot of money to invest into what they're going to put into their bodies on top of the food that you're eating. So well done. But again, it's like getting off my soapbox right now. Like, good wine lists are hard to come by. You guys have a really great wine list. That's awesome.
Well, I think it goes without saying, but that's why it's important when the chef gets involved in the wine, mm-hmm. because I think to your point, so many people build a wine list just about what people want. They want a Malbec. They want a Cab. They want a blah, blah, blah. And they don't pay any attention to, okay, well, does that Malbec specifically match our food? Does it pair with any of the dishes? And I think when you're in a restaurant setting, I mean, so many people glance over the fact that food and wine are magical together, as you said, and it's really important to try to have that harmony between mm-hmm. them. So
yeah, that alchemy is something that's special, and we're super picky about it. I mean, you've done tastings with Neil many times, yeah. and he'll take his favorites and bring them back to me, and I'll taste them blind and try to guess and evaluate them. And yes, we're really, really picky with what goes on there. Hopefully, to good effects that you're seeing, Max.
Yeah. And we'll get out of here with this, because we don't really do this anymore. But when you're at home. Or maybe what wine or beverage of choice, alcoholic beverage of choice, is in your fridge right now, or what's on the what was the last one opened?
It's when Elizabeth and I can get our hands on it. It's always champagne.
Always champagne.
Yeah.
Is there a house or a grower that you prefer? Or
no, I mean we'd love to. We don't have the big blue chip cuvées very often, but the growers are wonderful. As long as they're, again, not too flinty, too austere, but
okay, so that's the go-to. I know you guys have young kids, so it probably doesn't happen that often that you get to sit down and open pop a bottle.
Yeah, no, we're never sitting down.
Yeah,
no, seriously, we're cooking dinner and helping with homework, and
right.
And so, well, what about that? You're a chef, a business owner, a husband, and a father. Are you able to like have a decent work life? We've talked about this stuff so much, and like in the kind of the new era of running a restaurant, you're not supposed to have the machismo and work 100 hours any longer. That's like an old way of doing things. But I'm sure you were part of that during, your time coming up, because that's what we all did. But how is your balance of work life now?
It's under review at the moment.
Yeah, but, yeah, you're still not even a year.
Sort of,
if Elizabeth was here, what would she say?
That's she would agree. She would agree.
Yeah.
She
under review. Yeah.
But I think we both realize that I thought I'd be working every single day for the first year.
Yeah.
I mean, I get Sundays off and I usually take off a Thursday or Tuesday night as well. So the hours are long, and I miss the kids a great deal. And these are, ages and times when I want to be around more, but we're laying the foundation for what we hope is a long-term successful restaurant. The balance is always being evaluated and recalibrated.
The food and beverage industry has grown so much since we started doing this podcast, but I moved here 7 years ago, and there's so much that has developed in this triangle and in the state, but we can never have enough. You started here, you went out into the world, you honed your craft by learning from some pretty amazing people as well, and then you brought it back to the state, which is pretty awesome. This is something that a lot of people should be doing and explore, but then come back and give to the community of what you've learned. So get out there, go to Hawthorne and Wood, because it's just another great restaurant that's been built, and we need more of this to happen.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I agree too. I wish there were 10 more great restaurants on the way to Chapel Hill. Hopefully they're not far off.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
In many ways. Chef, thanks so much for coming in and spending some time with us.
Before you get out of here, we got to get you some ice cream.
Oh, all right.
Some proof alcohol ice cream. So you can take it back home. You and the wife can enjoy some alcohol ice cream. It's think differently about dessert. There's 7% alcohol in every pint.
Yeah, so you can still stand and eat it.
Cool. Not for kids.
Not for the kids, but we have a freezer out there in the kitchen with quite a few different flavors: bourbon caramel, strawberry moonshine, the coconut rum. So you go ahead and pick which one you want and take it back home and enjoy from there. Go to proofalcoholicecream.com for more information, or check the notes in our show notes.
Yeah, maybe have that ice cream while you're under review about your your work-life balance.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. Exactly. But other than that, everybody, go to Hawthorne and Wood, and you will eat and drink extremely merrily.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Max. My pleasure being here.
Awesome, man.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.